before we start on the dialogue with the non-Christian world, I thought I would make a few practical recommendations regarding our own most important American ecumenical work between ourselves and non-Catholic Christians. These are, of course, only personal opinions. I would like to recommend, however, as I have to, for example, seminaries when they ask me to speak on the subject, that the studies be at least somewhat adjusted to the ecumenical times. Above all, by instilling in the young trainees a desire, first of all, to help all Christians, and not only professed Catholics. The very fact that I realize that other people besides Catholics are also believers in Christ and are a legitimate object of my apostolic concern can change your whole viewpoint. One of the graces that I can honestly say I received in teaching at a state university, where upwards of one half of my students are not Catholics, is the realization of how willing, even eager they are to listen to and even be directed by a Catholic priest. I don't say it had a dawn on me only at the university, but certainly it has been much clarified for me to realize that I'm a priest not only for Catholics, but for all Christians. I think can change the viewpoint of a religious who realizes that the Christ in whom she believes is also believed in by millions of others, Methodists, Baptists, and others about whom too often we hardly know how to spell their names. One of the recommendations made by the Vatican Council is for adjustment and adaptation in the courses of study, not only in the seminary, which we incidentally are doing, but also in colleges. I quote, "We must get to know the outlook of our separated brethren. To achieve this purpose, study is of necessity required, and this must be pursued with a sense of realism and goodwill. Catholics already have a proper grounding, need to acquire a more adequate understanding of the respective doctrines of our separated brethren, their history, their spiritual and liturgical life, their religious psychology and general background." Unquote. That's a mandate from the Council. If this advice pertains to educated Catholics generally, I think it is mandatory for us religious who are professionally in the field of teaching. I like the expression which the Council uses, with a sense of realism and goodwill. The realism means that I do not ignore or underestimate the vast differences that divide Catholicism from other religious, albeit Christian, systems. This realism will protect me from falling prey to the naive Irenicism that Pope Paul recently strongly criticized when he charged some priests with criticizing the Church for its ghetto mentality, as though Catholic unity were something that we had imposed upon us by a tyranny instead of something that grows out of our own love for God. At the same time, along with the realism, recognizing there are profound differences, the goodwill preserves me from looking for defects in those who are not Catholic, instead of finding what we have in common and on which they and we can build an edifice of spirituality. Now for the subject of a dialogue with a non-Christian world. This is our third dimension. Some say this is a coming dialogue, coming in the sense that In many ways, the dialogue between ourselves and the Christian world is established as a dialogue. Its future may take centuries to develop. There are many reasons why contact, and therefore the ecumenical movement between ourselves as Catholics and Christians and the non-Christian world, reasons why it is not only relative, but highly imperative in modern times. For one thing, we have come to know in the last generation, at most 50 years, more about the non-Christian living religions than we knew in all the previous centuries put together. How so? One reason is that many of their writings, for the first time in history, have appeared in print in any language, let alone in the English language. The first definitive translation of the Quran of Islam. Now, as you know, Islam goes back to the 7th century. The first official definitive translation of the Quran into English appeared in 1950. Moreover, the trend of the world's unification politically, geographically, to the exchange of ideas has put us, that is the Christian West largely, with the non-Christian East, largely, in a way that we've never even heard about each other. Who ever heard about Vietnam until we got into a war in Vietnam? Polysyllabic names in Japan, for example, or China or India, which are now almost household words, came into being through the political, military, and historical development of the world. All of these reasons, then, more than suggest, they make mandatory on us. First to know ourselves, and then to communicate that knowledge about this more than one half of the human race, which I think, through our own Christian fault, is not yet Christian. In order to bring the prospects of this forthcoming dialogue into closer focus, we shall examine, and this time true to form, three major non-religious, in the sense of non-Christian cultures. They are religious, they are not Christian. We will examine Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam. The whole thing in 45 minutes. And I hope at least to pique your curiosity, and hopefully to, with God's grace, that course structures, plans in teaching, all the way down to the grammar school. I was up in Madison, Wisconsin a couple of months ago negotiating with the people over there at the University of Wisconsin and happened to visit at a Dominican convent, a local parochial school. And one of the sisters, the teacher in the eighth grade, when she heard I was there, she came to the parlor and she said, "Father, I'm very happy to meet you. The book that you wrote, this is not an ad, on religions of the world, I have found very useful in teaching my eighth grade. Of course, I trim it down for their mentality, and I've been using it for several months. All kinds of courses can be developed, I think." The children were so enthusiastic, they went home and told their parents what they're learning. All about the Sikhs. The parents had never heard about them. So what happened? The parents got together and asked the sister, would she teach them? She's having night courses in comparative religion. First, Hinduism. Hinduism, by its own professors, is less a religion than a religious culture. He does not have any of the structure that we normally associate with a religion. A set body of doctrine, less steel than authority. It may be simply called the traditional religious posture of the people of the Indian subcontinent. And even those who are Christian are deeply affected by this Hindu culture. It may be summarily described as the religion which seeks union with the absolute. In one of the famous pieces of literature of Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita, spelled B-H-A-G-A-V-A-D, Gita, or shortly, simply Gita, the God Krishna declares that whoever worships him with complete devotion, that is bhakti, B-H-A-K-T-I, I quote, dwells in me, whatever be his course of life, they who worship me devoutly are in me, and I also am in them. No doubt Hinduism stresses the unreality of the material universe. We talked about this in passing in one of our conferences. And calls the visible cosmos, things we see, Maya. No doubt also, Hinduism tends to identify its ultimate ground of being, Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, with the self, Atman, A-T-H-M-A-N. In other words, something that scandalizes us. The two foci of classic Hinduism, in other words, the unreality of the material universe, that the only real thing is spirit, and all else is unreal, is only appearance, is only Maya. And on the other hand, saying that there are not spirits, there are not personalities, there is only one thing, one reality, one being, who is Brahman. And then it identifies that single being in the universe with the self, with Atman, which of course makes it, on that basis, pantheism or monism. Now that certainly is a tendency. In fact, in general, it is the ordinary, you might say, drive of Oriental thinking. It is towards pantheism, that is, Oriental religions. However, these very preoccupations, the very preoccupation with spirit, and the desire for the spirit which is the ground of all being and my spirit to be united to the point where they are identified, highlights the essential feature of Hinduism, its profound spirituality, and its desire for communion of the soul with God. And this, as one Hindu writer after another indicates, is the great corrective that the so-called Christian West should have needs. We, with our materials, with our skyscrapers, and all other kinds of things, gadgets mostly, with which we've come to identify our developed culture, and we have, this is arrogance, to speak of the undeveloped nations. Undeveloped in what? In bathtubs and billboards. I have taught, this is not in my notes, I have taught people from India for over 10 years. And I don't hesitate saying this. As a group, I find people from the Orient intellectually superior to the average person from the West. Of course, there are fantastic limitations on food, on lodging, on all the things that indeed are sometimes even necessary for decent living. But this concern for things of the spirit, things of the mind, is such that they just put us to shame. The Upanishads, way back from BC times, to read those and to see the depth of insight into human existence, into man's relationship with the cosmos, with the origin of things, is such that few Americans, even few religious, ever taken a graduate school of philosophy. In terms of the dialogue, if we ever hope to affect or influence the almost 500 million, depending on your counting, Hindus in India, it must be through a reappraisal of our own spiritual potentiality. In other words, to exploit and develop the spiritual riches that we have, and to stop being so preoccupied with the vocationalism of brick, mortar, stone, and steel. Few of us realize how thoroughly materialistic our civilization is. And we especially, who both as Catholics and as dedicated religious, who should be, as we've said so many times, standing witnesses to this invisible world, we especially have the duty, certainly the opportunity, of developing the spiritual potential in the Christian West, which has become so materialistically minded, so that the East, which is not so preoccupied, if for no other reason it doesn't have those material things, to have them look at us as something more than automats pushing buttons. And correspondingly, in our own thinking, in our own reading and study, it is way past time for us to teach, and I mean teach, down to the lowest grades possible or feasible, with standardizing agencies or superintendents of schools, to teach the spiritual wealth of the East. Once in a blue moon, and it'll have to be a pale blue moon, that you'll find in any anthology of world literature, you will find a paragraph or two, a page or two, but whole courses of study can be developed, and in Catholic colleges, I would suggest, as a model, at least as something you can read about, the work that is being done at Marian College in Indianapolis. I've spoken there a couple of times. They have what I think is the only department of Eastern religions in a Catholic college in the world, really. It's not a big college. Of course, you've got to train your personnel. You can't read the Saturday Evening Post and give a course in Hinduism. The point is, this is something which the Church, under divine guidance, is telling us to come to know each other. They, us, and they won't even look at us unless we develop our spiritual potential, and they see that what we teach or preach as Catholics and Christians is real, that we are not so preoccupied with the things of this world as everything around us indicates. And secondly, that we become interested in them. Read their literature. They have centuries of it. In fact, the Vedas are traced out of the sacred writings of the Hindus to 2600 BC. We should look upon the visit of Pope Paul to India as a mandate from the Vicar of Christ to become interested in this world, which he made the dramatic gesture of going there. And from all reports, which I'm sure you've read about him, reports that I've got from personal eyewitnesses, simply a miracle of response of multi-million Hindus to see this man who for them symbolized the best of the Christian West. Now, Buddhism. Buddhism is commonly described, and by its own proponents, of course, is what it is, as a heretical offshoot from Hinduism. It may be roughly described as a Protestantism of Christianity, where Hinduism would be the base, the original religion, and Buddhism its offshoot, its development. But more accurately, it can be said to be a development of one phase of the Hindu religion, begun by Buddha, hence the name. Note, it is spelled B-U-D-D-H-A. In teaching the subject, this is the first thing I demand of the students. I tell them you're going to flunk unless you can at least spell Buddha's name. Begun by Buddha in the 6th century B.C. It is now professed by most people of Asia outside of India. And Christ's words about a prophet not being accepted in his own country is literally true in the case of Buddha. He never took root in India, though he was himself originally a Hindu and an Indian. Again, for the sake of convenience, to summarize a library, we may define Buddhism as the religion which seeks deliverance from suffering. The religion that seeks deliverance from suffering. As the story goes, alone in quiet meditation one night, while sitting cross-legged under a bow tree, Buddha analyzed and discovered a simple religious solution for the cause and cure of evil. Now, before we go into his own analysis, it is well to know that somewhere near the heart of classic Hinduism is a belief in reincarnation, which, as you may know, means that any person's present life is only one stage in many lives that all of us live, each incarnated either in a human being or sometimes in an animal. If we behave ourselves, our next existence in, shall we call them, the next human being we're going to be, will be good. If we misbehave, we'll be in a bad way. We may even become an animal. Not so clear how an animal is supposed to behave, but that's another problem. The fact is that reincarnation is of the essence of Hinduism. Buddha was much vexed over this problem of reincarnation. He could not conceive what had become the symbol of Hinduism, the perfect circle. Just as Christianity has its symbol in the cross, so Hinduism has its in the endless circle. The wheel of existence, it is called, where man goes from one existence to another, where he sheds, as the Gita says, his body like a cloak, where the one spirit, the Atman, takes on a variety of different incarnations. And in fact, the whole caste system of the Hindus is built on this premise. The four classes, from the highest to the lowest, and worse still, the pariahs, who are outcasts. And that, by the way, is C-A-S-T-E, outside of all castes. All of that depends on how those people behaved in their previous existence. And a Brahmin can become a pariah. He doesn't behave himself. The highest can become an outcast. Buddha was worried about that, as all Hindus have been over the centuries. None of them wants to just keep going, getting reincarnated. Dying, being born again, dying, being born again. So, he thought he discovered, and the Buddhists, of course, followed his teaching, that there was an escape from this wheel of existence. The escape was what he called the Four Noble Truths, which have since become the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. Watch the logic of Buddha. It is profound. And with that, more Christians had some of this, which is a valid insight. in their thinking. The first noble truth of Buddhism: all existence involves suffering. You can't live without it. Existence is impossible without suffering. Now the question is, where did this suffering come from? All suffering, so Buddha taught, is caused by indulging in our insatiable desires. Note the word insatiable. We keep searching, we keep wanting. What do we want? You name it, and we want it. The only thing necessary is for the idea to enter our minds. That's enough. And the only way we don't desire things is if we don't know about them. But in the nature of things, said Buddha, we never attain. And not only Buddha, but all of us can say, Amen. There is nothing we desire that we truly and fully attain. Nothing. For us as Christians in this life. For Buddha, these desires are insatiable. And they are insatiable because they can never be truly satisfied. How then do you get rid of suffering? Oh, that's easy. Get rid of the desires. And your sufferings will become less as you desire less. Isn't that good? Yeah, a chemist couldn't improve on that. But now, the fourth step, the way to suppress these desires is the so-called Eightfold Path of Buddha. Incidentally, in my passion for threes is possibly a reflection of my belief in the Trinity. In Buddhism, four is the operative word or number. Four of this, eight of that, 16 of something else. Always multiples of four. I'll just mention these eights, since I'm not giving a course in Buddhism, we won't go into this. The Eightfold Path, which is the way that desires get suppressed, is by having the right kind of views, which means to believe what Buddha taught, the right kind of aims to desire what he said you should desire, the right kind of speech to say the things he said you should, the right kind of action, the right kind of livelihood. That's a good one. And the livelihood, incidentally, means that a person lives honestly. The right kind of effort, which is inside. And the seventh is especially valuable. Right-mindedness. He discovered something what some religious take a long time to discover. That if you're going to have the right kind of views, aims, speech, action, or livelihood, or effort, you've got to have the right kind of thoughts in your mind. Sisters, that's positive genius. And with all the effort that I'm getting a little exhortatory here, with all the effort that we expend in controlling this, developing that, now we all know this to a certain extent, but to realize the root of it all is what's inside of my mind. I will never think, I will never be kind unless I think kindly. I will never be generous unless I think generous thoughts. I will never do things for others unless they are first on my mind. It just won't occur to me to do anything because the person is not on my mind. And notice, as we know from experience, it isn't how near things or people are to us physically that matters. That doesn't matter a thing. It's how inside of us people and things are. That's straight Buddhism. It's also good Christianity. And the eighth is what he calls right contemplation. When a person is finally lost in the contemplation of, now it depends on the system of Buddhism, in that Nirvanic world, Nirvana then is the ideal. The eighth step, when finally reached, puts a person into Nirvana, which was never clearly defined. And when his followers said, "Now, won't you please explain what Nirvana means?" He said, "What difference does it make? What I am teaching is how people should get there. There's a lot to that." To defend his position, he uses an example that I think is valuable for all of us. Suppose, he says, a man, while out hunting, is accidentally shot by a poisoned arrow. They didn't have shotguns in those days. And the man is lying, bleeding. His friends rush towards him, and they want to help him. First, of course, to pull out the arrow. He says, "Gentlemen, please, don't. Let's look into this thing. What kind of an arrow was it?" They tell him now. "What difference does it make? What kind of an arrow was it? What kind of a shaft did it have? What's the nature of the poison on the tip of that arrow?" By that time, Buddha says, the poor man will die. Sisters, that too is genius. We can become so analytic as to lose contact with the thing we are analyzing. In its pursuit of Nirvana, or deliverance, which is another word for it, Buddhism teaches a profound lesson to the Western world, telling it, man's innate desires cannot be satisfied. And if there is any error which the Western world has fallen into, it is the dogmatic claim, your desires can be satisfied, of course, here and now. Just make more money, get more education, you name it, and you will be thoroughly happy. No doubt, this non-Christian religion exaggerates the presence of suffering, because it says that all existence by definition is suffering. That's not quite true. Nor is it quite true to say that these desires are never to be satisfied. It does, however, remind us of something which could only have grown from the blood and sweat and dire poverty of almost 4 millennia of human suffering. No wonder our religion would be built on the essence of suffering, when these, by now, multi-billions of people have equated existence with suffering. How blasé Christians can be to claim they worship a suffering Christ and don't want to suffer even a passing headache. If it goes beyond, this is Buddhism, the evidence of claiming that desires are never fulfillable, and it does teach that. It at least opens the door to inquiry and acceptance of the eschatology of Christianity, which is not easy on its own, which in fact identifies its religion by the symbol of the cross, where the very word cross has become, in all Western languages, identified with some kind of trial or tribulation. Where then, Buddhism, recognizing the suffering that are inherent in man's existence, claims, because it knows no better, that these sufferings are purposeful. First of all, they have been caused by man, which Buddhism doesn't see, which Christianity teaches. The rationale behind suffering in Christianity is to explain the source of suffering. It is not God, it is man. Faith tells the Christian there will be no suffering, no death, no pain, no pain, unless man had sinned. That's our faith. It further tells the Christian, this suffering is not meaningless. It is certainly not merely having it stop. Notice the heaven of over 500 million people. The heaven of not suffering. For a Christian who believes in an afterlife, in the prospects of everlasting happiness, where the suffering patiently endured, and even, as for us, in our own ways, quite deliberately and openly undertaken, in little ways, sometimes bigger, in community life, in the life of the councils, all of that means it puts the cap of fulfillment on the aspirations of the hope of one-fourth of the human race. Finally, in our triad, Islam. This, by the way, is the correct name. It is not Mohammedanism. Mohammedanism is, or was coined by Christians. They always call themselves Muslims, and their religion, Islam. The word is the verb to surrender in Arabic. Islam then means surrender. And by implication to God, in perfect submission to His will. That's the essence of Islam, in fact, the description of its name. Here, too, we'd like to summarize it in a brief statement. It may, I think, be summarized as a religion of absolute monotheism. Muhammad, in the early 7th century, reacted against the polytheism of his day and built into the system of Islam a recognition of two things. That Allah, and Allah means the God, Allah the God, He alone, a pure spirit, is creator and Lord of the universe. And second, that man's peace on earth and happiness in life after death, there is an eschatology to Islam, depend completely on his surrender to Allah. Peace on earth, happiness after death, through Islam, through surrender to Allah. Now the way in which he surrenders himself to Allah is through all kinds of ritual prayer, up to 7 times a day, no matter where he is, and to make sure that he does not in any way show disrespect to Allah, he must pray either on clean sand or he spreads a rug over the filthy earth. He fasts in strict compliance, if he's a good Muslim, to the Quranic code, which is hard. The lesson for the West, he is not unlike that of Hinduism and Buddhism. The affluent society of Christianity in the West and its material prosperity have blinded millions of so-called Christians to the very existence of Allah and the responsibility to His will, which has pretty well been diluted to heredity or environment. Where the human will has creative of its own actions is almost denied outside of really Christian questions. All sorts of evidences of, again, the materialization and correspondingly the de-divinization of the West, where, as we quoted in a previous conference, Muslims, a man like Iqbal, have nothing but disgust for those who place their highest treasure in the things of this world. One beautiful passage in Iqbal that I've never forgotten. where he says, this is in the West, the only ties that bind people are money and blood, and not, as for us, the Spirit of God. One more dialogue. In this field, sisters, you see immediately, I feel myself terribly handicapped. These are courses that I teach. 30 to 40 lectures. Finally, therefore, the dialogue with an unbelieving world. This is the fourth of our series, given to us, actually, by the Holy Spirit. On first blush, it would seem that it is impossible to engage in any meaningful dialogue with those who are not only not Christians, but are not even believers. First of all, we should remind ourselves that the number of those who answer to this definition, those, in other words, who are not believers, is myriad. The whole communist world is built on the premise, in its own philosophy of life, that there is no spirit outside of matter which is finally responsible for the existence of the material universe. As one of the lectures of Stalin that I had occasion to read a text of, did you know he used to teach in the university? He was no fool. And one of his theses, which he taught in the lectures, was a parody on the statement of St. John, in the beginning was not the word or spirit, in the beginning was matter. So there are multi-millions who are enslaving almost half the world now, given the 600 million people of China, under the heel of communism, which is basically, in its leaders, a philosophy of atheism. But there are also very many in our own United States. People, in other words, who are either professed atheists, or at least in practice, behave as though they didn't believe in God. Perhaps the majority are agnostics. Remember my first registration at the university, in the big field house, and, you know, you have chairs and you have your place set for you. And I was sitting behind our department section there, and the wife of one of the faculty cuddled up, and she said, how are you, Father? She said, you know, the first statement she made, you know, I am an atheist. I said, how interesting. Won't you sit down? After about 20 minutes of this dialogue with non-believers, she said, you see, I am no philosopher. At least I think I got through. Now, according to Pope John and the present Holy Father, Catholics should not turn away from contact with and dialogue with this unbelieving world. Of course, we must protect ourselves and Christian interests from opposition. But we are told not to run away from, and in fact, in the United States, how can you do it? Now, when dealing with unbelief, two things I think should be kept in mind. First, that atheism and agnosticism are not static things. Now, this is not obvious. Not that truth itself is static, but truth has a consistency to it. Even one who is searching for the truth, and surely one who is in possession of the truth, now, he shouldn't sit down and squat and go to sleep because he's got the truth. Nevertheless, there is a stability of mind, there is a fixity of purpose by the very definition of truth. You've arrived. Which is not true of what is by definition untruth. In other words, and this I've seen time and again with my own students, many of whom are agnostics. They have an evolving mind. They develop. They change. And very often, what looks like almost violent opposition is just there, flexing their muscles and trying to adjust themselves to reality. Given time and effort, and of course, our cooperation, there can be, and I have seen remarkable changes of heart. Secondly, that atheists and agnostics are often sharper critics of things that need to be severely condemned than we who, in the nature of things, have, for example, the law of charity, which binds us. They will condemn, as communism has condemned, as Christians should have condemned for centuries before, the exploitation of the poor, the wars of aggression, racial injustice, hypocrisy in private and public life. In the infidelity of those who profess to believe in God and behave as though they were God. They are shrewd observers, and as I have learned to sometimes be affected by, they can be incisive critics. It means then that, on the one hand, we do not either despair of their change of heart, or in especially, offer to them, present to them, the things which they are searching for, the oppressed they're searching. And on the other hand, to be sympathetic with things which they condemn that deserve condemnation. Let us not close our eyes to evils in the Christian world. Let us castigate Christians who are not behaving as they should. And incidentally, you win their hand of fellowship almost immediately. For me, one of the finest examples of this was of a dialogue that I had with a man by the name of Paul Van Buren from Temple University. The two of us were to speak at Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan last fall. He was to speak in the afternoon, and then I would take notes while he was talking and raise some questions. At night, I was to talk, and he would take notes, and he would ask questions. In the afternoon dialogue, Paul Van Buren gave, really what was, a whole series of professions of agnosticism. So I said, Dr. Van Buren, how would you describe yourself when my turn came? I'm not too sure just what you are. And I gave him some suggestions. And he said, I am an atheist. Then I still remember he took a gulp of water just to, you might say, swallow that statement. That evening, I spoke. And I began on that second tack, believing, as I said, that many people call themselves atheists, are opposed even to God, not because they hate God, but because they hate people, or hate the things that people who claim to believe in God are doing. His first statement was, if what you say is true, I would seriously look into the faith you profess.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.